adjusted the elevator to full speed, the team found themselves quickly at ground level without feeling a thing. "So what did you think?" asked a Notice executive. "It's fast, all right," responded a Concept team member. "But we were really looking for gut-wrenching, hair-raising, free-falling thrill." To that, the surprised executive responded, "What? And undo everything we've been trying to perfect for more than a century? Our success comes when you feel like you're not moving at all." It was then the team realized how incredibly different this new elevator would have to be, and that it would be up to Imagineering to take it to a whole new level. With that, Disney created one of the world's largest ride system motors to power the attraction. 12 feet tall, 7 feet wide, 35 feet long, and weighing in at 132,000 pounds, the two massive motors had to be hoisted atop the tower's framework, specially constructed to support their weight, via giant cranes. The motors are capable of accelerating 10 tons at a rate of 15 times the speed of a normal elevator, while generating torque equal to that of a combined 275 Corvette engines. The Tower of Terror opened on July 22, 1994. The design and architecture were inspired by several Southern California landmarks, most notably the Mission Inn and Biltmore Hotel, and the landscape and grounds around the attraction have hints of Griffith and Elysian Park. The building housing the attraction stands 199 feet tall and features more than 27,000 roof tiles. Changed from its original format, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror at Disney's Hollywood Studios multiplies the thrills inside the 13-story haunted hotel with a recent technology upgrade that actually places the attraction in control of each ride experience. It's the first Disney attraction in the world to offer random experiences and the first where the attraction actually determines the ride sequence. All the ride sequences are unique and random. These random ride-and-drop sequences make the attraction faster and more entertaining. In addition, visual, audio, and olfactory special effects make the Tower of Terror one of the most advanced multi-sensory attractions anywhere in the world. Ghostly apparitions, rocketing ascents, more airtime, and cannon blasts of chilling air are just a few of the surprises in store for you as you check into the hotel. Here's a bit more from one of the attraction's show producers. Tower of Terror affects every one of the senses, leaving you feeling as if you have really been in your own episode of The Twilight Zone, says Theron Skies, show producer for Walt Disney Imagineering. A team of Walt Disney Imagineers worked very hard to break the barrier and truly immerse guests in the experience. Adding sound technology, scent, and visual effects is only part of the way we achieve this. We wanted the guests to feel completely out of control, not knowing what to expect next, and giving the diehard fans a lot more to talk about. The ride's fright-filled ascent begins when visitors board a decrepit hotel freight elevator that passes through mysterious hotel passageways, where ghostly images of lost guests seem to appear and disappear at will. As the journey progresses, the elevator cage hurtles through the fifth dimension in a pitch-black shaft as guests embark on a not-to-be-forgotten journey. A trip on this elevator could definitely become problematic for some younger riders. It's dark and has sudden drops. Put on your best screaming face, as your pick will be taken. FastPass Plus this bad boy, especially since there aren't a whole lot of other things to do at this park. Disney's Hollywood, or Real Hollywood, a trip down Sunset Boulevard, wouldn't be a proper trip unless you experienced some rock and roll. Legendary venues along the Real Sunset Boulevard, such as the Whiskey A Go-Go and the Roxy Theater, have been rocking music lovers for decades. So, of course, Disney Hollywood Studios' rock and roll-centric roller coaster would be found on their own Sunset Boulevard. Are you ready to rock? I hope so, because 3,403 feet of twists, turns, loops, corkscrews, hills, and dips await you at Rockin' Roller Coaster starring Aerosmith, just next to the Tower of Terror. The attraction begins with a tour of a fictional record company, where you'll encounter Aerosmith finishing up a studio recording session. The band, formed in the early 1970s, actually recorded a few special tracks for their namesake ride. Their hit, Love in an Elevator, can be heard as Love in a Roller Coaster, and What Kind of Love Are You On? Became What Kind of Ride Are You On? After being invited by the band to see them in concert, guests climb aboard a 24-passenger super-stretch limo, inspired by early 1960s Cadillacs, and begin their journey into the darkness, which is fueled by speed and music. The ride features two rollover loops and one corkscrew, Disney's first coaster in the United States to feature inversions, and starts with a high-speed launch that catapults each limo train to approximately 60 miles per hour in 2.8 seconds. Have you ever wondered what it felt like to take off in a supersonic jet from an aircraft carrier? Well, the beginning of this ride has a similar feel. In addition to the speed and excitement of the ride, each limo train has a total of 120 speakers. And each guest seat on the attraction has two high-frequency tweeters, two mid-range speakers, and one subwoofer mounted under it. All in all, the entire attraction boasts 900 speakers and puts out more than 32,000 watts of audio. Here are a couple of things to look out for as you enter the attraction and work your way through to the actual ride. Note the name of the fictional record company, G-Force Records. According to Dictionary.com, a G-force is a force acting on a body as a result of acceleration or gravity, informally described in units of acceleration equal to 1G. For example, a 12-pound object undergoing a G-force of 2Gs experiences 24 pounds of force. As you enter the first inversion of this ride, you'll feel roughly 4 to 5 Gs. As you exit the attraction, check out the 40-foot-tall electric guitar neck that morphs into a roller coaster track and extends out 320 feet toward the entrance arc. Definitely FastPass Plus this ride, too. The height restriction here is 48 inches. Let's walk back down the street and go toward Hollywood Boulevard. When you're at the corner of Sunset and Hollywood, make a right, walk a few feet, and you'll see the Hollywood Brown Derby. This restaurant has a lot of Hollywood and culinary history attached to it. As the Imagineering Field Guide to Hollywood Studios explains on page 32, opened in 1926, its novelty form, that of a brown derby hat, was reportedly inspired by the hat worn by 1928 Democratic presidential nominee Al Smith. This location was such a success that plans were made to open a second restaurant nearby. Just up the street near the corner of Hollywood and Vine, the Spanish colonial-style Hollywood Brown Derby opened in 1929 and immediately became a hub for the social activity of the movie crowd from the growing film industry. Celebrities and studio executives frequented the place, which quickly became known for covering its walls with caricatures depicting all the famous faces that came to the restaurant. The Brown Derby is known for several signature dishes, which are always offered on the menu at our restaurant. The Cobb salad, according to legend, was invented one night when Brown Derby owner Robert Cobb went into the kitchen to pull together a late-night snack for Chinese theater owner Sid Grauman, who was supposedly suffering from some dental work done earlier in that day. The finely chopped mix hit the spot to such a degree that Mr. Grauman and others began requesting it. And another legend, sometimes debated, holds that the Shirley Temple beverage was created at the Brown Derby so that the underage starlet would have her own special drink. An interesting little side note from this story about the Brown Derby. As just explained, the theater owner who supposedly inspired the Cobb salad, Sid Grauman, owner of the Chinese theater, was well represented here at Hollywood Studios until August 2017. Just diagonal to the Brown Derby was the attraction The Great Movie Ride, which was housed in a replica of Grauman's Chinese Theater. But now, it's just part of the Disney Extinct Attraction Club. As mentioned a few times, Disney's Hollywood Studios is undergoing a makeover, and the theater, an original landmark attraction from the park's opening day, is undergoing a renovation. It will be home to the future attraction, Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway. Currently, each night the building serves as the backdrop for the evening show, Star Wars, A Galactic Spectacular, which, if you're at the park in the evening, is a must-see. Since we're still near the Hollywood Brown Derby, let's walk toward the Echo Lake area of the park. You won't be able to miss the lake in front of you. This lake is inspired by a man-made lake in Los Angeles, Echo Lake Park. In the early days of Hollywood, many silent films were shot there, most notably a few flicks starring Charlie Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy. You'll see Min and Bill's Dockside Diner, a boat docked at the lake. The Min and Bill referenced here are characters from the 1930 movie with the same name. Marie Dressler and Wallace Beery were the stars of the movie. Dressler won an Oscar for her role. Behind Min and Bill's boat, just across the lake, is Gertie the Dinosaur. Gertie is a character from the 1914 animated cartoon Gertie the Dinosaur. Gertie was created by animator Winsor McKay. As you wander around this area, be on the lookout for a few of Gertie's footprints. While this area may not offer a lot to actually do, there are quite a few places to eat. The restaurant Hollywood and Vine offers a buffet-style meal with some of your favorite Disney characters. If you look at the exterior of the restaurant, there are a few references to the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit? One window has the outline of Roger Rabbit, and another makes reference to Eddie Valiant, the private detective from the movie. Again, as we've seen throughout Walt Disney World, there's a 1928 for the building's address, which is numerically symbolic for Mickey Mouse. Inside the restaurant, check out the painting on the far left wall. You should be able to spot a rough sketch of Mickey Mouse, and if you look really carefully, find the groupings of trees in the same mural. The trees make up a traditional hidden Mickey shape. If you like your meals with a side of sauciness, then look no further than the 50s Primetime Cafe, which is next to Hollywood and Vine. Here, you can enjoy comfort food from the 1950s, but be sure to keep your elbows off the table or you may get scolded. The food here comes with a heaping side of sarcasm and humor. If you're seated near one of the black and white televisions, look at the brand name. It's not a Sony, but a Disney. Hopefully, you're not too full from all the food at Hollywood and Vine or the 50s Primetime Cafe, because it's time for two big helpings of George Lucas. The next two attractions we are going to cover are based upon Lucas's blockbuster movie franchises, Indiana Jones and Star Wars. Indiana Jones' epic stunt spectacular is inspired by the blockbuster film Raiders of the Lost Ark. The show recreates edge-of-your-seat scenes with stunt performers demonstrating techniques Hollywood uses to fool moviegoers into thinking a favorite celebrity has taken a punch, fall, or bullet. Against the backdrop of temple ruins, Indiana Jones makes a grand entrance, and the show swings into nonstop action. In pursuit of the golden idol, Indy and his companion, Marion, battle dangerous bad guys, leap from tall buildings, and make other daring escapes as fake bullets fly and a moving vehicle bursts into flames. As the two heroes triumph over traps, villains, and epic obstacles, a director explains the movie magic, such as how to safely throw and take punches, fall from tall buildings, and even wield whips in the midst of complex action sequences. The sequence of the scenes lasts 32 minutes and is staged in a 2,000-seat amphitheater, allowing guests a close-up view of the action. From the audience, a small group of volunteers are selected at the beginning of each show to participate as extras. The show runs throughout the day. The legacy of the Indiana Jones franchise is firmly cemented in movie history, but it pales in comparison to another film franchise from George Lucas, Star Wars. When Disney decided to utilize Lucas's work in their theme parks, it was a big shift for the company, as Star Tours would be the first attraction at a Disney theme park where the story or movie being featured didn't come from an exclusive Disney or Disney-adapted storyline. As then head of the Walt Disney Company, Michael Eisner wrote in his book, Work in Progress, Disneyland and Walt Disney World remained immensely popular and successful long after Walt's and Roy's deaths. Unlike movies and television, which needed to be virtually relaunched from scratch, when Frank and I arrived, all the parks required was updating, expansion, and renewed excitement. We turned our attention first to Disneyland, where it seemed possible to make a difference most quickly and easily. One of the first calls I made was to George Lucas. No movie maker had a more original blend of storytelling skills and technological imagination. Our idea was to recruit George Lucas to help us produce new attractions, building them around the immensely popular characters from movies such as Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark. George was instantly enthusiastic, partly because this was a way to reintroduce the movie characters he'd created to young audiences, but mostly because it would give him the chance to experiment with new forms of three-dimensional storytelling. He quickly set his sights on an Imagineering project based on NASA-developed flight simulation technology. Using Star Wars characters, the ride was designed to create the feeling of a wild trip through the universe. George had the idea that the spaceship ought to be flown by a psychologically unbalanced rookie pilot named Rex, making it plausible for a series of disasters to occur in the course of the flight. Frank and I arrived at Imagineering one day to see an early version of the ride, which we were calling Star Tours. We were dressed in business suits, but ready for thrills. At this stage, the outside of the ride was little more than a giant box on stilts. I was completely intimidated by its long legs and shaky ladder we'd have to climb to get into the box. Frank led the way. I followed reluctantly, along with two or three Imagineers I hoped could double as paramedics. When the ride began, we rocked to Star Wars music. We rolled to a comedy soundtrack. We tossed and we turned. When we emerged, I felt elated. I had just experienced a genuinely new kind of ride. Frank had turned a pale shade of green and looked as if he was about to faint. Based partly on this experience, we modified the ride so that not even queasy or nervous riders would get flight sickness. The Frank Michael was referencing in this passage was Frank Wells, who was Disney's president until he tragically died in a helicopter crash. Check out his window on Main Street. It pays homage to his love for adventure and mountain climbing. The magic of Lucas and Disney came together and brought the Star Wars galaxy to life in Star Tours at Disneyland in 1987. On December 15, 1989, Star Tours blasted off to Endor at Walt Disney World Resort. The original version of Star Tours was in operation until 2010. In 2011, the version we see operating today, Star Tours, The Adventures Continue, debuted, featuring an improved ride simulator attraction with advanced 3D technology, unique branching storylines, and an expanded universe of scenarios and characters based on the entire Star Wars saga. With multiple story combinations, Star Tours, The Adventures Continue, offers a unique experience and trip almost every time, as more than 50 random story combinations are used. The many different twists, turns, and destinations include the underwater realms on Naboo, the bustling city planet of Coruscant, the dreaded Death Star, and encounters with C-3PO, R2-D2, Darth Vader, Boba Fett, and Admiral Ackbar, or any combination of the above. At the moment, Disney's Hollywood Studios is very Star Wars-centric. After you've finished your trip on Star Tours, you can watch the 10-minute film retelling the Star Wars saga at Star Wars: Path of the Jedi, watch the March of the First Order, and take part in the Jedi Training Academy. For ages 4 to 12, participants must register at the Indiana Jones Adventure Outpost. Availability is limited, and it's first come, first served. If those experiences aren't enough, go visit the Star Wars Launch Bay, where you can check out movie props from Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, play games, snap photos, screen videos, and say hello to BB-8, everyone's favorite Wookiee, Chewbacca, and Kylo Ren. The launch bay is a full-on celebration of all things Star Wars. Since Disney purchased Lucasfilm in 2012 for $4 billion, the company has continued to expand the Star Wars franchise and universe. In 2019, Disney's Hollywood Studios will be home to a Star Wars-inspired land where guests will be able to see the Star Wars stories come to life. Also, be on the lookout for a hidden Mickey when you're in the gift shop, Tatooine Traders. There's a hidden Mickey in blue lights at the lower part of the sales desk. We're leaving one major Disney acquisition and heading over to another, this one from the opposite end of the entertainment spectrum, or shall we say, universe. Just a quick stroll down the walkway from Star Tours is Muppet Vision 3D. Despite having different owners, or parents, Kermit the Frog and friends, and Mickey Mouse and his pals almost seem to be kissing cousins. Therefore, the entertainment world wasn't too shocked back on May 16, 1991, when the Muppets set up shop at Hollywood Studios. This date was exactly 1 year and a day after Jim Henson, creator of the Muppets, passed away. Disney co-developed and co-produced this attraction with Jim Henson Productions, and it was the last major project Jim personally worked on. During the time of production, Disney was in talks with Henson to acquire Kermit and his crew, but Jim's sudden death derailed the acquisition. In 2004, Disney finally sealed the deal, and according to Jim Henson's daughter, her father would be pleased. Commenting on the sale to Disney in a press release, Lisa Henson said, "In the months before his death in 1990, my father, Jim Henson, pursued extensive discussions with the Walt Disney Company based on his strong belief that Disney would be a perfect home for the Muppets. As such, the deal we announced today is the realization of my father's dream and ensures that the Muppet characters will live, flourish, and continue to delight audiences everywhere, forever." The 12-minute 3D film, with a smattering of live action in the actual theater, is inspired by the classic television program The Muppet Show, which aired from 1976 to 1981. Even the 584-seat theater is inspired and designed to resemble the theater the Muppets would frequent on their show. During the film, get ready for a few 4D pranks. And if you have a sharp eye, you will be able to notice the hidden Mickeys toward the end of the film. Watch as the fireworks are ignited. When one of them explodes, you'll see it form a hidden Mickey. This one may be a bit tough to see, but you'll have another opportunity to catch a little Mickey eye candy. In the last scene of the film, Kermit the Frog is on a fire truck. Don't fixate too much on Kermit. People in the background are wearing Mickey Mouse ears and carrying Mickey-shaped balloons. As you exit the film, head back up the walkway towards Star Tours and make a left and head into the sci-fi dine-in restaurant. The setting here is a 50s-style drive-in theater where you're served a big helping of kitschy 50s sci-fi clips and cartoons during your meal. Think burgers and fried pickles, which happens to take place in a retro car. The scene is set as the stars twinkle in the nighttime sky in this outdoor drive-in set within the Hollywood Hills. Disney designed and handcrafted 34 car-shaped booths for your dining experience. As recounted in the book Walt Disney Imagineering, Bill Casey's early concept design combined the styling of a classic 50s convertible with restaurant tables, thus creating the world's first and only convert-table. For the auto upholstery selection, they actually tracked down a source in Detroit that carried new old stock, an auto restorer's term for goods that are vintage but brand new in condition. The fabrics actually came with certificates of authenticity. As you're dining and relaxing on some of that new old stock, check out the license plates on the backs of the cars. The letters and numbers are the initials and birth dates of some of the Imagineers who worked on the restaurant. Walking out of the sci-fi, make a left and walk toward the ABC commissary. The restaurant is nothing remarkable, but if you're a lover of ABC television, there are a few interesting pieces of memorabilia from The Goldbergs, Modern Family, and Speechless just as you walk in. We're going to continue all the way down Commissary Lane, head back toward the center of the park, and make a quick stop at the Animation Courtyard. Feel free to pop in and go under the sea at the Voyage of the Little Mermaid. The 17-minute show runs throughout the day and features live puppetry based on The Little Mermaid. As you walk past the building, look at the large mural and see if you can spot the hidden Mickeys represented in bubbles near Ursula. Walt Disney once famously remarked, "I hope we never lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a mouse." That was a very humble statement by him, but as we all know, it was all started by Walt. So when you leave the Voyage of the Little Mermaid, take a few minutes to appreciate the genius and legacy of your host, Walt Disney, at the multimedia presentation and self-guided gallery tour of Walt Disney Presents. The presentation of Walt's life was originally created to commemorate the 100th anniversary of Walt's birth. Walt Disney Presents gives you the chance to discover the man behind the mouse, his many achievements, and his ongoing legacy, from Mickey Mouse to Magic Kingdoms and beyond. The next stop at Disney's Hollywood Studios is Toy Story Mania. Fast pass it, fast pass it, fast pass it, within the Pixar Place area of the park, which is designed to resemble Pixar's main campus in Emeryville, California. Just like the Muppets and Lucasfilm, Disney had a relationship with Pixar Animation Studios, albeit this relationship, at times, was complicated and turbulent. But the fate of Pixar's Woody and Buzz ended up just like Kermit's and Darth's in an acquisition. The blockbuster movies created at Pixar became another jewel in the crown of the Kingdom of Disney when Pixar was acquired for $7.4 billion in 2006. Believe it or not, Steve Jobs became a billionaire due to his ownership of Pixar, not his financial interests in Apple. So, after the Pixar acquisition, it only seemed natural that another Toy Story presence should happen at the Disney theme parks. Remember, Buzz Lightyear is in Tomorrowland at the Magic Kingdom, and in 2008, Disney took the concept of an interactive, shooting-type game with Pixar characters to the next level, with Toy Story Mania. The theming and design are terrific and immediate. Even before you enter the attraction, you may notice the scale of things are a bit off. As you step inside the building, you're actually stepping into Andy's room. You'll notice enormous board game boxes as the walls and board games on the ceiling. Guests are meant to experience life at the size of a toy, so in Andy's room, a 5-foot-6-inch person will feel about 14 inches tall. The murals located in the load area are the largest murals painted since Epcot was built. With 3D glasses in hand, you climb aboard a 20th-century-inspired carnival ride tram, complete with a spring-action shooter. This allows you to take aim at a variety of targets during the 5 unique virtual carnival games. Sharpshooters can hit targets that trigger special 4D effects. It has been estimated that each day, guests may break more than 1 million virtual plates using the spring action shooters during this interactive game. In order to create a show that responds not only to every pull of the guests' spring action shooters, but also every move the Midway tram makes, there are more than 150 computers communicating over multiple networks throughout the attraction. So, how did this super successful attraction come to be? Disney gave the New York Times an in-depth look at the backstory and creation of Toy Story Mania in the article, "Will Disney Keep Us Amused?" from February 8, 2008. The introduction of a ride called Toy Story Mania, more than 3 years in the making and estimated to cost about $80 million, the attraction essentially puts guests inside a video game. Riders wearing 3D glasses board vehicles that careen through an old-fashioned carnival midway, operated by characters from the popular Toy Story film franchise. Vehicles stop at game booths, 56 giant screens programmed with 3D animation from Pixar, and riders play virtual reality versions of classic carnival games. Work on Toy Story Mania got underway on a stiflingly hot September day in 2005 when a team of Disney creative developers went to the Los Angeles County Fair. The goal was to research how carnival games operate. Two developers, Kevin Rafferty and Robert Coltrane, had devised an idea for a new California adventure ride that would juxtapose the old-fashioned romance of a carnival midway with high-tech video game elements. They had a hunch that Toy Story and Toy Story 2, the Pixar films about toys coming to life, would provide a good theme. But they didn't know much about carnival games. We looked at each other and said, "Are the games we remember from our childhoods even relevant anymore?" Mr. Coltrane said. At the fair, the two were thrilled as they walked through rows of game booths, wooden structures that carnival operators call stick joints, to find crowds enjoying classic games like the ring toss and water guns. We were like, "Score!" and gave each other a high five, Mr. Coltrane recalled. Using digital cameras, members of the development team documented details, from the colors of the canvas covering each booth, red and yellow, to how far apart the games were spaced. They quickly ruled out some games as options for the ride. "Toss a coin in the cup didn't really do it for us," said Chrissy Allen, a senior show producer. But other games, like one in which customers threw darts at balloons, piqued their interest. "We thought, this just might work," Ms. Allen said. Reassembling at Disney's offices in Glendale, California, the team worked on the concept that would become Toy Story Mania. Because carnivals sell commotion, there would be lots of flashing lights, barkers trying to capture riders' attention, buzzers and bells. Mr. Rafferty and Mr. Coltrane dreamed up a fanciful story. The classic toys in Toy Story had come to life and staged a carnival under their owner's bed while he was away at dinner. To give birth to Toy Story Mania, Mr. Rafferty and Mr. Coltrane went to work turning drawings of the ride into foam models, toiling in the same 1950s-era building in suburban Los Angeles where Walt Disney himself once tinkered. Upstairs, designers entered blueprints for the ride into a computer program. This would allow them to start building and refining the entire project, which is made up of 150 computers, with 90 of them moving around on the ride vehicles and communicating with one another via a secured wireless network. With a click of a mouse, developers could jump to any spot inside the vehicles for a virtual dip into how the experience might look to someone on the ride. "We don't want anybody to be able to see multiple versions of Woody at the same time, and seconds make a difference," said Mark Mine, the technical concept designer. "Every part of the ride has to be magical." Across the street, in a cold, unmarked garage, more than 400 people of all ages, all had signed strict non-disclosure agreements, sat on a plywood vehicle set up in front of a projection screen, and played various versions of the games. Disney workers studied their reactions and interviewed them afterward. "We were looking to see if some effects were too scary," Ms. Allen said, "or if there wasn't enough laughing happening during certain sequences." Among the discoveries, people wanted to be able to compare scores after they were finished playing, while some children had a hard time reaching the cannon-like firing controller, christened by Disney as a spring action shooter. Engineers added a computer screen to vehicles to display scores and installed the controls on movable lap bars. "We were trying to find out things we didn't even know to ask about," said Sue Bryan, a senior show producer. The ride's psychological components started to take shape during this phase. Disney decided that riders were happier when they got a bigger visual payoff. One of Little Bo Peep's balloons now pops with greater force when hit with a virtual dart, and a blast of air shoots into a rider's face. A game involving shooting at a paper target was dropped. It was hard to make paper interesting, Ms. Bryant said. And developers decided that the last game before the exit needed to be the easiest, so writers would feel that they were coming out as winners, even if they weren't very good. After Disney closed the Pixar deal, in January 2006, Toy Story Mania became more elaborate. Mr. Iger wanted Pixar, and particularly one of its co-founders, John Lasseter, who had worked as a skipper on the Jungle Cruise ride at Disneyland after college, to contribute to creative advances in the parks. One of Mr. Lasseter's major concerns about Toy Story Mania centered on the animation. Disney had hired an outside contractor to handle it, but Mr. Lasseter insisted that Pixar staff members who were involved in creating the films should also work on the ride. The Disney team had also decided to leave out Buzz Lightyear, the modern spaceman toy in the films, because he was already showcased in an older ride called Astro Blasters. But Pixar felt that the character was essential to the Toy Story franchise. Buzz will now be a host of a game, and he shares top billing on the ride's marquee. Well, nearly a decade after the ride debuted, I think it's safe to answer the New York Times headline question, will Disney keep us amused? Just by watching the standby lines for this attraction when you're at the park, the answer is a resounding yes. Let's close out our trip to Disney's Hollywood studios with a bang. As you leave Toy Story Mania, start heading toward the exit of the park. Make a left onto Sunset Boulevard and walk down the street toward Tower of Terror. Enter the Hollywood Hills Amphitheater, a 6,900-seat building that can also accommodate 3,000 standing guests, designed specifically for the evening finale, Fantasmic. Lights, lasers, fireworks, and water, lots of water. The moat around the stage holds 1.9 million gallons, play a crucial role in this nighttime outdoor musical. Fantasmic takes you into the colorful imagination of Mickey Mouse as forces of good and evil battle it out. The characters and spirit of Beauty and the Beast, Sleeping Beauty, Peter Pan, The Little Mermaid, Cinderella, Aladdin, and The Lion King, to name a few, all play a part in this spectacular of dancing and synchronized water and song from Disney classics. The 25-minute spectacular features about 50 performers who use about 80 costumes per show. The dragon in the show is roughly 50 feet tall and has a wingspan of 50 feet, and the steamboat is 80 feet long and weighs about 70,000 pounds. Quite impressive and entertaining. Fantasmic is presented on select nights, with performance times varying based on park hours and weather. There's even a Fantasmic dining package you can reserve. Have dinner at Mama Melrose's Ristorante Italiano, Hollywood and Vine, or the Hollywood Brown Derby. And this allows you to secure guaranteed seating for the show after your dinner. Fantasmic closes out Disney's Hollywood Studios for us. We're now off to the final theme park at Walt Disney World, Disney's Animal Kingdom. Before you board any attraction, check the signs for warnings regarding heart, back, blood pressure, and neck issues, along with risks to riding while pregnant. The following descriptions and blurbs come from the Walt Disney World Resort website. Disney Hollywood Studios Attractions. Muppet Vision 3D. Experience the magic of the Muppets during a hilarious, eye-popping film and live-action extravaganza. Rock and Roller Coaster starring Aerosmith. Race through the darkened freeways of Los Angeles in a super-stretch limo to the rockin' tunes of Aerosmith. Sunset Boulevard. Star Tours. The adventure continues. Make the jump to hyperspace as you ride aboard a 3D motion-simulated spaceflight to popular destinations from Star Wars. Echo Lake. Star Wars Launch Bay. Animation Courtyard. Interactive exhibits and shows. Toy Story Mania. Ride and blast moving targets at this Midway-style 4D shooting game starring your favorite Toy Story characters. Pixar Place. The Twilight Zone, Tower of Terror. Hurtle up and down aboard a haunted, elevator-themed ride. You're about to enter the Twilight Zone. Sunset Boulevard. Disney Hollywood Studios Restaurants. Hollywood Boulevard. The Hollywood Brown Derby Lounge. American Cuisine, Table Service. The Trolley Car Cafe. American Bakery, Quick Service. Sunset Boulevard. Anaheim Produce, American Cuisine, Quick Service. Catalina Eddie's, American Cuisine, Quick Service. Fairfax Fair, American Cuisine, Quick Service. Hollywood Scoops, American Cuisine, Quick Service. KRNR, The Rock Station, American Cuisine, Quick Service. Rosie's All-American Cafe, American Cuisine, Quick Service. Echo Lake, 50s Primetime Cafe, American Cuisine, Table Service. Backlot Express, American Cuisine, Quick Service. Hollywood and Vine, American Cuisine, Table Service. Min and Bill's Dockside Diner, American Cuisine, Quick Service. Oasis Canteen, American Cuisine, Quick Service. Tune In Lounge, American Cuisine, Table Service. Commissary Lane, ABC Commissary, American, Quick Service. Sci-Fi Dine-In Theater Restaurant, American Cuisine, Table Service. Grand Avenue, Baseline Tap House, American Cuisine, Table Service. Mama Melrose's Ristorante Italiano, American Italian Cuisine, Table Service. Pizza Rizzo, Italian Cuisine, Quick Service. Entertainment. Meet a few characters. Be sure to check the times for the meetings once you're in the park or via the My Disney Experience app. BB-8 Astromech on Duty. Say hello to this excitable sidekick at Star Wars Launch Bay before he takes off on another important mission, Animation Courtyard. Celebrity Spotlight. Stop by the Celebrity Spotlight at Disney's Hollywood Studios to hang with your fave frosty friend from Disney's Frozen, Echo Lake. Disney Visa card member Star Wars character experience. Beware the dark side during a character experience with Kylo Ren at an exclusive location for Disney Visa credit card members, Animation Courtyard. Encounter Kylo Ren at Star Wars Launch Bay. Prepare to confront this imposing First Order warrior on the bridge of his ship, straight out of the Star Wars saga. Animation Courtyard. Meet Buzz Lightyear and Woody at Pixar Place. The stars of Disney Pixar's Toy Story films are ready on set at Woody's Picture Shoot and Corral, Pixar Place. Meet Chewbacca at Star Wars Launch Bay. Get ready for a rebel rendezvous with this legendary Wookiee warrior, Animation Courtyard. Meet Cruz Ramirez on Pixar Place. Make a pit stop for a chance encounter with Cruz Ramirez, a new character from the Disney Pixar film Cars 3, Pixar Place. Meet Disney Junior Pals in the Animation Courtyard. Say cheese and hi to some favorite Disney Junior stars in a fun-filled picture and autograph session, Animation Courtyard. Mickey and Minnie starring in Red Carpet Dreams. This classy couple is destined to see their names in lights and sign autographs for adoring fans like you. Commissary Lane. Live entertainment and shows. Beauty and the Beast, live on stage. Be swept into the romantic fairy tale of the Beast, who could only be saved by love in this lavish Broadway-style musical, Sunset Boulevard. Citizens of Hollywood, plant your feet as this improv acting troupe brings the silver screen to the street with a little help from the audience, Hollywood Boulevard. Disney Junior, live on stage. Enchanting puppets, whimsical scenery, and catchy songs invite preschoolers to sing, dance, and play. Animation Courtyard. Disney Movie Magic. Relive your favorite moments in cinema with classic projections that feature the magic of Disney. Fantasmic. See the forces of good and evil battling it out in Mickey's Dream during this nighttime outdoor extravaganza musical, Sunset Boulevard. For the first time in forever, a Frozen sing-along celebration. Delight as Frozen springs to life in this lively retelling, packed with a flurry of stories, songs, and sing-alongs. Echo Lake. Indiana Jones Epic Stunt Spectacular. Cheer on Indy and Marion as they perform amazing stunts with blazing special effects to demonstrate movie-making magic. Echo Lake. Jedi Training, Trials of the Temple. Watch younglings train in the ways of the Force and put their skills to the test against the dark side. Echo Lake. March of the First Order. Clear the way for Captain Phasma as this ruthless commander leads her squad of stormtroopers up Hollywood Boulevard to center stage at Disney's Hollywood Studios and witness a daunting demonstration of the First Order's obedience and strength. Hollywood Boulevard. Star Wars, A Galactic Spectacular. Conclude your day in a galaxy far, far away with an all-new nighttime spectacular bursting with memorable Star Wars moments. Voyage of the Little Mermaid. Immerse yourself in unforgettable moments of the hit animated film The Little Mermaid at this live show puppetry extravaganza. Animation Courtyard. Chapter 4. Animal Kingdom. I have learned from the animal world, and what everyone will learn who studies it, is a renewed sense of kinship with Earth and all its inhabitants. Walt Disney. First a rabbit, Oswald, then a mouse, Mickey. Add a few dogs, Pluto and Goofy, a grumpy duck, Donald, an elephant, Dumbo, a deer, Bambi. The list could go on and on. Disney is very animal-centric. Walt Disney's love and appreciation for animals dates back to his childhood days on a farm in Marceline, Missouri. Today, it's hard not to acknowledge that much of the success of the entire company is rooted with animals. As the company grew and thrived through the 1930s and 1940s, the interaction and utilization of these critters leaped from the cells of animation and into the realm of documentary, with True Life Adventures, an Oscar-winning nature series beginning in 1948. Disney basically created the concept of the nature documentary. By 1955, Walt had his theme park, Disneyland, stocked with plenty of animals, mostly mechanical. As mentioned in the first chapter, Walt really wanted to use live animals at the Jungle Cruise, but it didn't come to fruition. When speaking about Disneyland in 1956 to reporter Pete Martin, Walt remarked, "The park means a lot to me in that it's something that will never be finished, something that I can keep developing, keep plussing and adding to. It's alive. It will be a live, breathing thing that will need changes." About 42 years after this interview, Walt's company opened a park that is alive, living, and breathing, literally. Disney's Animal Kingdom debuted on April 22, 1998, Earth Day no less, and features over 2,000 animals, representing roughly 300 species. Every day, about 4 tons of food is consumed by the park's residents, including more than 2,000 pounds of vegetation. Over 40,000 mealworms, wigglers, and night crawlers are consumed weekly, in addition to 80,000 crickets per month. It's no wonder that since the park opened, Disney's lab technicians have analyzed more than 40,000 samples of animal poop. Over on the flora side of things, there are more than 4 million trees, plants, shrubs, vines, epiphytes, grasses, and ferns, 3,000 different species from every continent on Earth except Antarctica. Across the theme park's 400-plus acres, more than 770,000 shrubs were planted, with nearly 70,000 trees being planted in Africa alone. So, how did this cow pasture, tree farm, fireworks test site at Walt Disney World turn into Disney's fourth theme park? It all started back in early 1990. Imagineer Joe Rohde had a meeting with Michael Eisner about an animal theme park. Rohde envisioned a park with three equal components: traditional theme park, Epcot-style pavilion, and non-traditional zoo. He pitched the idea, and Eisner agreed on the basic framework. That initial meeting even decided the park's name when Eisner remarked, "You know, we have the Magic Kingdom. We should have Disney's Animal Kingdom." The name stuck. A consistent underlying vibe that loomed large over the project was how the park wouldn't be a zoo, per se. As research showed fiscally, a traditional run-of-the-mill zoo wouldn't make sense or money for Disney. Another doubt about the park was the notion of being able to give guests a feeling of shared space with wild animals. Is observing animals really that thrilling or exciting? This concept was explored and elaborated upon in the book The Making of Disney's The Animal Kingdom. Eisner wondered, are guests going to feel that animals are exciting enough? As the design team caucused in their Spartan warehouse, their rallying cry was, "Proximity equals excitement." The plan that emerged was so audacious that the team dared not confide it even to Marty Sklar, Imagineering's creative leader. Joe Rohde began the next meeting with corporate executives by squarely addressing the issues of animal encounters. "We know that there are concerns about whether animals are, in and of themselves, dramatic. The heart of the Animal Kingdom Park is animals, and our guests' encounters with them. We have gone to great lengths to make sure the animals will be displayed in a way that will bring them and people together as never before." The door to the room opened. A 400-pound female Bengal tiger, restrained only by a slender chain, walked in. Rohde ignored the huge cat and kept talking as she prowled the room, coming within inches of Disney's key executives. The effect on everyone present was palpable as the tiger, all rippling muscle and powerful claws, walked restlessly around the edges of the room. Disney President Frank Wells edged his chair closer to the table. Eisner stared. Sklar, kept in the dark by the team, gasped and looked at Rohde. Twitching its whiskers, the tiger sat in the corner of the room, yawning, as Rohde continued, "Yes, there's an element of danger, but that's necessary for drama. Physical danger is an essential fact that animals deal with every day, and we want to drive that idea home." The tiger sauntered behind Rohde and was let out of the room as he concluded, "So you can see our position, proximity to animals, the illusion that they are right next to you, is essential." In a brief interview I had with Joe after referencing this story, I asked him if he had anything else he could share about that day. He told me, "Honestly, the event is very well covered in the book. I think we made the point that we never told anybody or asked permission. One humorous note is that this event has been reported by various resources over the years with quite different versions of what the tiger did. Jumping up on a table, growling at Michael Eisner, letting me ride on its back, lots of variations." And with that, it was quite obvious that Disney's Animal Kingdom would be a different species of theme park. Disney's planning and research were kicked into high gear. On the corporate level, an advisory board was created to guide the assembly of a humane, eco-friendly, conservation-minded park. The board would consist of consultants, members of animal and wildlife protection groups, zoologists, and curators from zoos across the country. Even legendary primatologist Jane Goodall joined the team. For the design and creative component of the park, executive Joe Rohde and a core team of seven Imagineers crisscrossed the globe to the tune of more than 500,000 miles, the equivalent of circling the world 20 times, to ensure the authenticity of the areas of the park they were seeking to replicate. As reported in the Orlando Sentinel on April 19, 1998, "We've tried to be very thorough in inventing this place," said Joe Rohde, the park's chief designer. "We sent probably 30 people over 5 or 6 years to Africa, 6 or 7 different trips, and took thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs." While Disney's Animal Kingdom is accredited by the American Zoo and Aquarium Association, everyone associated with the park will tell you it's not a zoo. Yes, there are animals throughout the park, but they are involved in a story that transcends the simplicity of a zoo. While the animals are the stars of the show, the underlying storyline and presentation is how we live and interact with animals and their environment, and to recognize and value this man-animal-environmental dynamic through conservation. Believe it or not, Disney's Animal Kingdom isn't the first live animal-centric park with an eye toward conservation at Walt Disney World. Before Joe Rohde and Michael Eisner had a spark of imagination about Disney's Animal Kingdom, Walt Disney himself, on one of his early flyovers of the land he purchased in Florida, became smitten with an 11-acre piece of land residing in the middle of a lake. This little island caught his eye and helped him to decide that this area of his property should be developed first. That little island still stands today in Bay Lake, just adjacent to Magic Kingdom. When Walt Disney World originally opened, the island was dubbed Blackbeard's Island, but it never opened as an attraction. 3 years later, in April 1974, it was renamed Treasure Island and debuted with a pirate hideaway and lost treasure theme, which was short-lived. On June 1st, 1976, Discovery Island debuted, featuring an animal-centric theme. The island was home to many exotic birds, plants, American alligators, and Galapagos tortoise exhibits. The island was created to educate guests on conservation efforts, breeding, and research. At its height of popularity, it was home to more than 130 species, totaling roughly 1,000 animals. Although the majority of the animals were birds, there were also small, exotic mammals, such as the Patagonian cavy, a kangaroo-like rodent, and ring-tailed lemurs. In 1979, the island was accredited by the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. Through the 1980s, Discovery Island worked to raise and breed many rare birds. Often, birds that were injured and wouldn't be able to survive in the wild would call the island home. In 1987, a nonprofit organization that places trained monkeys in homes with disabled people forged an agreement with Disney to help oversee their breeding. Helping Hands, Simian Aids for the Disabled, placed their colony of 53 capuchin monkeys in a specially created colony on Discovery Island. The monkeys were there to educate the public and share the ways they were being trained to help those suffering from paralysis. By the late 1990s, declining attendance numbers and competition from Disney's Animal Kingdom spelled the demise of Discovery Island. The park closed in April 1999, a year after Animal Kingdom opened. Discovery Island still lives on today. Obviously, the actual island can still be seen when you're near the Magic Kingdom, but the hub, right in the center of Disney's Animal Kingdom, which leads you to the different areas of the park, originates at Discovery Island. So let's go check it out. As you stroll toward the entrance of the park, keep an eye out for a mythical-looking creature, or perhaps something a little beastly. You may see a unicorn or a dragon on a park bench, or a symbol on a pole in the parking lot. These are references to one of the original lands planned for the park, the Beastly Kingdom. The area would have had a theme centered around mythical creatures, but it never came to fruition. These little details are the lingering reminders of some of the initial plans for the park. As you pass through the entrance of the Animal Kingdom, the shady, lush, and very green oasis awaits you. This peaceful pathway of streams, flora, and fauna fully embraces you. The giant anteater, exotic boar, and wallabies are a couple of the animals residing in the oasis. There are also a few observation areas to enjoy the scenery or snap a photo or two. Walking deeper into the oasis, you can almost feel the stage being set for something grand, perhaps larger animals and a greater adventure. The transfer to a different time and place has commenced. The vibe here is similar to, yet different from, visiting the Magic Kingdom. You walk under the train station and onto Main Street. You walk a few steps and see Cinderella's castle. The same feeling occurs as you leave the oasis and walk toward the Tree of Life. This iconic structure is surrounded by a village and situated on Discovery Island, which is the hub of the animal kingdom, the epicenter of the park. It leads to the lands of